This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
What is the role of authenticity when you vote? The feeling that a politician's presenting in an authentic way. And on that score, how would you rate our political leaders? Albanese, Taylor, Canavan, Hanson, the independents. In this conversation hour, I'm curious about the role of authenticity and how you define it. Is it how leaders talk? Is it how they dress? Is it the job they used to do? This, of course, off the back of Andy Burnham's success in that crucial by-election in the UK we were talking about in yesterday's show. That has him on the precipice of the UK leadership. And even if you only half listen to the talk of UK politics, you'll have heard it was a charismatic Burnham versus a personality-free zone Keir Starmer, but also that he presents as more of a man of conviction and authenticity. So I'm asking you, what does authenticity mean to you? What does it look and sound and feel like? It's become a bit of a buzzword, so I want to drill down. Is it using plain language or slang or even what used to be swear words we've heard politicians use in recent times? Or is it overrated? Has it become such a buzzword that, ironically, it's become meaningless? Tell me about how important authenticity is to you. Is it rare? Do our leaders achieve that? Which ones would you nominate? And if so, how? How do they reach you? How is that authenticity coming across to you? Also today, look, I'll be honest, I didn't know who Clive Davis was when I learned of his passing this morning. It turns out he was a music industry executive stalwart across multiple decades, responsible for promoting literally dozens and dozens of incredibly disparate stars. So his longevity really struck me. It's remarkable in an industry that sees so much churn. So I'm keen to know whose music has formed the background tracks in your life over decades. Which musicians have stuck around in your life over a period of time? Mine would be all of the ones who are currently celebrating 50 years in the business. I've seen Cold Chisel and Split Enz, very lucky too, and about to see Mental as Anything as well. They would be on the soundtrack of my life across decades. I'd love to know who are the goats of the soundtrack of your life. Give me a call. I'd love to hear from you about all of the musicians. Are they over 50 years? Maybe you're a lot younger than me and they're still over a decade or multiple years in your life. Give me a call. And also, I'm going to be asking you what the role of authenticity is when you vote. That's coming up next.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Before we begin, Noel in Belgrave, you wanted to say something about politics? Hi, Noel.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. How are you?
That's good. I rang in about, I think you're missing the word vulnerability. Mm. Without vulnerability, you don't have any trust, and no politician shows vulnerability anymore. Like Jess, I heard the first interview that Jess had with Raphael Epstein.
Jess Wilson?
She just said, Jess Wilson, yeah, sorry. She said, let me be clear, and she deflected, and I just thought, oh, well, we're done. It's just, this isn't going to work because she's showing no vulnerability. Without vulnerability,
so
there is no trust. So we don't trust because they don't just, there's no vulnerability.
So in your mind, Noel, that's interesting. Vulnerability means an ability to answer the question as well.
Correct. You're correct. They just deflect the question. It's like, oh, I can't show any vulnerability. I can't show that I can't answer this question. So they just don't, thinking that that's the best thing to do, but it's not. It's just like, just don't answer the question. It looks better.
And that affects your vote, Noel?
Oh, absolutely. When I heard that first interview with her and she said, let me be clear, and she just deflected, I just said, oh, we're done. We've got four more years of this. What do we do now? It's just like, put my hands up in the air. So we're done.
Noel, thank you so much. Do you agree with Noel? Is it also the way they answer questions? Is that really important for you? We're talking about this because of the rise and rise again of Andy Burnham, who's on the precipice of being PM in the UK. And part of the reason for this, according to my next guest, is about his authenticity. You know my next guest, that is, of course, Cos Samaras, who's pollster with Redbridge and a former Victorian Labor strategist. Hi, Cos. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
How much does authenticity account for Andy Burnham's success in your view?
Goes to your previous listener's point also about vulnerability. Both are actually the same, really, in terms of how voters interpret the world around them when it comes to politics. And that is, well, if you don't know the question or you don't know the answer or the answer is uncomfortable, just be honest. Mm. But equally, if you've got firm beliefs around about what you should be doing as a politician about your country, express it. And I think that's where the power of Andy Burnham comes from. And he's developed over many, many years a very strong brand around that. And
Because I was reflecting on the relationship between authenticity and brand. Mm. To me, it's a bit oxymoronic. Can you, if it is a brand element, then is authenticity inauthentic? What would you have to say about this post-meta world
Yeah, I use the word brand as in that's what people know you. How that people know you. It's basically, it's a persona.
Not marketing.
It's your identity. It's not marketing. No. It's basically, you know, Andy Burnham speaks his mind. Pauline Hanson speaks her mind. And you hear that a lot. And so, Mandami in New York speaks his mind. And so that's, I think, what people are starving for. And not only then speaks their mind, but in the serious politics of whether it's in the UK or in the US or in this country, people eventually also want serious solutions to serious problems.
Because in your focus groups, I know that you ask these questions of perception as much as, you know, voting intentions and so forth. This idea that we're starving for people who speak their mind, it's ironic in a world, isn't it, where so much of what we're literally seeing and hearing can be fake. Is it? Does one lead to the other?
Yeah, there is a growing sense amongst the Australian public that whether they are seeing a 15-second grab from a particular politician answering a question or whether they see a particular spin or meme online, most of it is in the realm the best term you can use is that they think that it's not real and it's not authentic. And you can't trust anything you see or hear anymore. And, of course, that creates a political environment that we're now witnessing writ large, not just in this country but across most Western democracies.
Mm. 1300 222 774. If you'd like to join the conversation and say, what does authenticity mean to you? Is it the way someone speaks? Is it how they dress? Is it the sort of thing that they used to do in their real life and that actually cuts through to you? 1300 222 774. Authenticity in politics seems to have been part of the reason why Andy Burnham has got to where he is. Again, as I say, he used to be in Westminster, became mayor, went away, dealt with the real world, one might say, Cos, and then came back again. Also, what's been noted is his personality. Keir Starmer was sort of famously globally roasted for a sort of lack of personality as well. You're really making a difference there. You're saying personality doesn't mean so much as this idea of being an authentic self.
Yeah, that's right. One thing we could say about Keir Starmer is that whenever he was asked questions around the problems that country is facing, and they're quite existential, it lacked substance, it lacked policy. He was elected on a very, very shallow policy platform and then didn't really build on it. And this is where all his problems stem from. And the only things that, you know, people in the UK can remember from his government is that the first 6 months of his term, they removed the energy rebate in the middle of winter for pensioners.
Mm. And so we are, as I say, on the verge of that happening there. And, you know, we've seen so many, I think it was seven, is it, prime ministers in 10 years in the UK. We've talked about what lessons Australians might be able to take from from Labor losing so much of its support in just a couple of years. What do you think is going to be the one thing that Australian politicians will be taking out of what's happening in the UK?
I think it's now very evident that what we're seeing in this country, that it has been occurring in the UK for some time. So the lessons they should have taken out of the UK over the last couple of years is that there is a exponential increase in the fragmentation of politics, full stop. Mm. And it's now emerging here in this country. And again, we're seeing the same thing writ large. That said, I would say that up until now, I think now they're starting to realise they've got a problem, particularly on the coalition side, that they are being basically replaced by an alternative. And to a lesser extent, the Labor camp is now going to come under pressure in particular geographies and electorates from One Nation. But I'd rather be on Labor shoes right now than the coalition in this country.
You're listening to Cos Samaras, who is, of course, pollster with Redbridge, former Victorian Labor strategist. I'm asking you what authenticity in politics means to you. 1300 222 774, is it the way someone speaks? Cos, a lot of what I'm seeing on the text is about following Noel's first call. It is about interviews. This is on text. Authenticity is answering questions. Albo just repeats rehearsed lines in his post-budget interview with RAF. David Pocock says Sue is a classic example of authentic, answers questions and doesn't spin. It really, there's still, as much as we talk about the decline of the media, the performance in the media really does mean such a lot still.
It does, because you could sit in front of a journalist and conduct an interview. That interview is going to get cut and clipped in numerous formats and socialised across the countless platforms. So it still matters, absolutely. And how you deliver that is very important. And what we see also, the clips that go viral are the ones that actually are, wait for it, authentic. Right,
but
the ones that don't are the ones that are bland and boring.
Okay, so interesting that you equate being on social media, and Jess Wilson certainly is an example of someone who's embraced that tactic. But even you're saying the silliness is authentic, isn't that also really contrived?
Yeah, it has to be natural, right? But it's also being frank and committed to your political beliefs also is important, and that will go viral as well. So there are some politicians, I think, across the political spectrum that are doing this really well. Is it Ed Husic from the federal government? He's a New South Wales MP, speaks his mind across a whole range of very, very challenging issues like AI, and he's very popular as a result of it. I would say Andrew Hastie, who over in WA and obviously part of the opposition, his interview on the Insiders program, I think, was quite impactful. And he just answered the questions straight, didn't spin it. Again, very powerful interview, very, very strong in his convictions as well.
I'm seeing Gough Whitlam. I'm seeing Obama and Jacinda Ardern. I'm seeing Jackie Lambie. Mary from Bendigo says Tanya Plibersek, Jenny Macklin, Jacinda Ardern. All women come to mind first. Interesting, Mary says that, and you were mentioning the men. Is there any gender aspect to this?
Oh, mainly because men have dominated politics for such a long time, really. I mean, would say Jacinda Ardern, yes, I would say she was pretty good in that space. She wasn't there long enough. But then I would say that if you find another politician across the world, Margaret Thatcher. A lot of progressives might not like her, but boy, she spoke her mind.
Speaks her mind.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, because someone who isn't speaking, well, I shouldn't put it like that, there have been some non-answering of questions about whether the Teals are going to be forming their own party. Mm. We suspect this may happen, if not with all of the Teals. I guess my question for you in the context of this conversation is that age-old, will the Teals lose some of their authenticity, or any independents lose their authenticity if they form a party? What do you think of their success if they do that?
Yeah, if a party of this nature is established, it would need to obviously continue the style of politics, which is, you know, Senator Pocock's approach, which is speaking your mind, not compromising on your beliefs, tackling really complex problems that the Australian public are demanding from their political class at the moment. But to the broader point around, is this sort of political movement, does it have potential? And I would argue it does. There is a portion of the One Nation vote right now that is looking for an alternative, but there's not one on the market at the moment, but they would prefer an adult version of it, to be blunt. And at the moment, they're just sitting on One Nation. That group will probably fall into the arms of this new movement. There will be people currently voting Labor, Liberal, right across the spectrum. So there is a market for it, there's no doubt. When we speak to Australians, they are looking for an alternative. Many actually don't go to One Nation because they think One Nation's, you know, too right-wing, or it's very controversial, and a few policy areas they don't agree with.
Cos, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Cos Samaras is Director of Redbridge, former Victorian Labor strategist. Jenny says, authenticity is that I believe the speaker believes what they say and it doesn't matter whether I agree or not with them. Chris says, Mary, there's that well-known adage that sincerity is everything in politics, and once you've learned to fake that, you have made it. I'd like to keep that conversation going. It is the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. But I was also asking you about the people who are forming the background music to your life over decades. Clive Davis is a legendary music executive and he existed over decades. Maybe it's him, but nominate who you think has grown with you as you have grown. Who has been that musician sort of stuck around with you? Stephen in Altona, who would you nominate for you?
Oh, hello.
Hello, Stephen. Who do you nominate?
Hi, how are you going?
Yeah, good, thank you.
That's good. I'd nominate Ed Cooper. Australian musician who, you know, started with the Saints. And I was listening to them from a teenage years through to the Laughing Clowns. So many solo releases. I mean, he's the hardest working musician in Australia, I think. And he's still going now. He's working with people like Jim White and doing other projects. So
you stick with him as he has stuck with you?
Absolutely. And he's a really nice bloke too. I've met him at the merch desk after gigs and, yeah, really lovely. Nice, down to earth and humble and, yeah, a good guy and a great musician.
Stephen, thank you. So that's Ed Cooper from Stephen. Pete in the Otways, who would you nominate?
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Carlos Santana. And as much as years and years and years ago, he did an album with a guy called John McLaughlin. And then I read an interview a couple of years after that in Guitar Player magazine, and they said to Carlos Santana, do you think that your music worked with John McLaughlin? And he goes, yeah, but that wasn't the object of it. The object was to help those on the preface, take a step. And they were into meditation, spirituality and stuff at the time, and I was only 14, and that just turned my life around, put me in a totally different direction. I haven't listened to Carlos all my life. I listen mostly to classical music now, but...
Why? How did it change your direction?
Such a big thing.
What was the thing that resonated?
Well, yeah. I was just going to school, doing the normal kind of things, and it just opened my mind to turning my senses within. And instead of seeking satisfaction externally the whole time, it enabled me to find something precious inside myself that's kept me alive, out of jail and out of a psychiatric hospital for the rest of my life. So I'm pretty appreciative of it, to tell you the truth.
Wow, yeah. I was just asking about a soundtrack. It sounds like you got kind of a guru with it all in one.
Yeah, to a degree, Just open. It was, as you said, it was to help those take a step that they wouldn't have otherwise took. And yeah, it did.
Pete, thank you so much. That's really interesting. I now want to go and listen to a bit more Carlos Santana. Robert from Melton, who would you nominate as the soundtrack of your life? Yes?
Mary, I have to nominate Paul McCartney. I've got to say, I've been a Beatles fan since 1964. Actually, all four Beatles, they changed my life and they made my life a wonderful life. And I've never stopped listening, buying records and listening to music, and it's the greatest thing you can ever, the greatest gift that the Beatles ever gave to everyone.
Oh, that's true. And the gift is that he still keeps on giving, Paul McCartney.
He certainly does, and so does Ringo. Ringo's still recording. So,
oh, really?
It's still, yeah, Ringo's still recording. I just picked up a new EP from Ringo, so he's still getting around. But music, there's so many great musicians. And the fellow said, Carlos Santana, oh, I've got that album with Santana and John McLaughlin. And I've also got a lot of John McLaughlin and fantastic guitarist, great Great music.
Oh, Robert, thank you so much. Of course, Paul McCartney, what a great nomination. Chris in St Kilda, who do you nominate?
Well, two musicians particularly. You just have to say Joni, and that's it.
Joni.
And John Martin, the British.
Right. And so you're still listening to John and Joni?
I've been listening to, well, I'm 66 and I think I first heard John Martin when I was 14 and I still listen to him and I still listen to Joni.
Chris, that's fantastic. Yes, thank you. I'm asking for other nominations as well. The musicians that have stuck around and got some beauties there. Do you agree? Who else would you nominate as someone who has grown with you, stuck with you as a musician over decades? Because we're going to be talking about an executive, a music executive. We don't normally see or hear of these people. Clive Davis was a legend in that regard. We're going to be talking about his extraordinary legacy next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Picked out Houston, Aretha, Alicia Keys. I believe Grateful Dead is even in his legacy as well. Of course, I'm talking about Clive Davis, who over decades helped artists. We're going to be talking about his life, but I'm also asking you, who are the musicians that have lasted for decades in your life? 1300 222 774, who've stuck with you and you've stuck with them. I'm hearing Supertramp, ELO, of course, Van Morrison, all the ones you mentioned. That's Sky from Mornington. Tell me who you'd nominate. 1300 222 774. Joining me now to talk about Clive Davis is Tim Kelly, who's a former label exec as well for Sony and Universal Music. He's currently program director at the Australian Institute of Music and doing a PhD on the music business, so we can ask him how many people are like Clive Davis these days. Hi, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Mary. Great to join you.
I'll go to, how typical a Clive career can be these days. But give us a bit of an idea. I guess we had a lot of a clue there, the sort of the breadth of the legacy that Clive Davis leaves behind.
Oh, it's an enormous legacy. And he, he was in the music business from the mid-60s. He still had a chair position at Sony until, obviously, he passed yesterday. And that's an incredible legacy. And he worked with many, many amazing artists, many of whom you just played the snippets there. Alicia Keys still sounded great, didn't it?
Oh, it still does. She, gives me just shivers. And, of course, because it was over that amount of time, he has overseen, withstood, outlasted so many trends and churns before Music Biz even got onto TV and the music video stage. How did he do that?
Well, partly it's just, he was given senior positions in 1967. He was made head of Columbia Records, which is now part of Sony, which is one of the big record labels. And so that's his job. But I think one of the standout features is he managed to keep those positions as the decades went on. And essentially, one of his great skills was spotting a great single. And if you deliver hits, you're delivering the budgets that your bosses want, and you have more chance of keeping your job. So I think he particularly when MTV came in and it became more about the single and the image of the artist and that promotional aspect of the artist, that probably led into his strengths rather than being a pure music guy, like some of the other leaders in that period. So I think that ability to spot a commercial hit was something that was quite powerful there.
I'm asking you, who are the people in your life, the musicians who've stuck by you over decades and you've stuck by them? Rowan in Tura, who do you nominate?
JJ Cale.
Oh, yes. How old were you when you first discovered?
Oh, no, it's in high school. No, I'm 69 now, but I think it was 72, I think, that album came out naturally. And, you know, just those really laconic, laid-back kind of licks he's doing a guitar, really kind of bluegrassy blues. You know, he influenced Clapton and Mark Knopfler. Just,
yeah.
Just something about him.
Yeah. He stuck with you and all these...
He's no longer with us, though.
Yeah, well, that's right. You're still listening, though, to him, Rowan?
There's a CD in my car right now. JJ Cale, naturally, I haven't got it on, but it's always sitting there.
Rowan, thank you. AJ in Dimboola, who are you nominating?
David Bowie. I got my first Bowie album in 1972 and continued getting all his releases way down until... his last one that he released 2 days before his death.
Yeah, and it didn't hurt that he just kept reinventing himself. Was that the key?
Oh, I think that was the key. I think that the song Changes actually represents what his musical career was about. And he was always progressing completely different musical angles, and that was amazing.
Mm.
From as I say, I was a rebel, and then I became a young American, and then I was a hero. So,
were you ever Major Tom?
No, I never. I was never Major Tom, but I did have the Ziggy Stardust spiky hair style as a 13-year-old.
AJ, great nomination. We are going to talk about Clive Davis a little more, but let's stick with nominations from Ian in Mornington Peninsula. Hi, Ian. Who do you nominate?
G'day, Mary. I'm 76 and left Australia in 1975 and worked in Europe and England and came back in 1980. Without any doubt, I believe people my age, it's John Farnham.
Oh, yeah. That's a classic. So
you know, to go to his first concert, really big concert at the Tennis Centre and take two young children and followed him all the way through and all that heartache that he had when he was younger and people taking advantage of him and then coming back was just amazing.
Coming back and talking about reinvention. Absolutely. Fantastic nomination. Thank you, Ian. On the line still is Tim Kelly, who's a former label executive for Sony and who's at the Institute of Music as well as program director. Tim, we're hearing there about the musicians who've lasted that long, and we're talking about Clive Davis, who's died after a stellar career as an executive. Can a music executive have that sort of career anymore? Our minds turn to Michael Gudinski, of course. Is that sort of success breeding success, is that how it still happens these days?
Yeah, you can. I mean, those kind of, you know, multi-decade careers, I think, are becoming rarer and rarer. But if you look at the current heads of the major record labels, Lucian Grange at Universal and Rob Stringer at Sony, these guys have been with their companies for 20, 30 years. So they're not far off in terms of the longevity that someone like Clive Davis has. I think... one of the reasons we know a bit about Clive is that he was an amazing self-promoter. He really did make it about himself when he had success. And that doesn't tend to happen that often these days. The executives are behind the scenes. But also I think Clive represents an old business where executives made their reputations by breaking new artists into the market and taking these unknown would-be stars like Whitney Houston and then being part of the journey to make them stars. Whereas the music business these days is a lot more about mining older hits, the stuff that was created in the past for profits, rather than generating new superstars for profits.
Oh, we need to get you back to talk about that. Seems like a whole different discussion, Tim. But thank you for telling us a bit more, and particularly me, about Clive Davis today.
Thank you.
Tim Kelly is a former label exec for Sony and is at the Australian Institute of Music. And I've been asking you as well, who have been the musicians that have hung around for decades for you? Shane in Torquay, who would you nominate? Hello, Shane.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Who have you been listening to for decades?
Look, I grew up, I'm 73, I grew up listening to Neil Young. I still listen to him. He's the most amazing musician. I started listening when he was in Buffalo Springfield back in the late 60s. And he's done everything. He's done folk, rock, grunge. And the favourite track actually is with a live track with Pearl Jam doing Rockin' in the Free World.
Yeah.
And I've seen him probably four times. Each time he does, he's different. Like, I saw him at Festival Hall. He had the International Harvesters with him, which are sort of a grungy country band, I suppose.
Yeah.
And, my mother, who is 98, still lists After the Gold Rush as her favourite album.
Shane, that is a terrific nomination, yeah, and does still keep giving. Thank you. Peter in Caulfield, who's yours?
Well, it's not so much as an artist, but a song that has stuck through with me, and I'm 8 years old. It's often been dug up from the memory books in my mind. The song is Jimmy Cliff's I Can See Clearly Now, The Rain Has Gone.
Ah.
It's become a mantra that pulled me up from various difficult situations. It's a great mantra. If you had time, please play it in the background.
Oh, Peter, that is beautiful. Even just thinking about that song, yeah, it just makes me breathe out. That's a really good call. There are some songs that hang around as well as the soundtrack. Thank you. Michael in Tasmania, who are you nominating?
Hi, Mary. I was just thinking about this last night, actually, because it's 40 years ago this month that Paul Kelly released Before Too Long, which was the single off the Gossip double album that introduced me to Paul.
Mm.
And I've been with him ever since. He is the greatest songwriter in Australia, if not the world. I mean, his ability to write songs about love and sex and heartache and death and God and everything in between
is, I love it,
enormous. And I've seen him so many times live. They're always brilliant.
Yep.
And he keeps changing. He changes as we've got older together. His ability, you know, I feel like we're mates, even though I've never met him, because, you know, he's writing about stuff that is now relative to a person we're of a similar age.
Oh, Michael, that's so true. We get that parasocial relationship and then it just feels like a real relationship. And why can't we celebrate that? Thank you for all of the nominations. And if we've got time, we'll get to more on the Conversation Hour. I can see Stevie Wonder, the Bee Gees, Tex Perkins. Maybe we could even get to a little bit of music in this Conversation Hour. But it is coming up to 20 minutes to 12 on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Let's talk now about the deadly bird flu that's been detected. Now, you might think that it's going to be a risk, obviously, to the poultry industry, and it is. But what does it mean to all of us? And also, what does it mean to the wildlife? And how do we need to look out for this in our lives? Want to dig into that this morning. Ewan Ritchie is Professor of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at Deakin University and join me now. Ewan, thank you. What wildlife has already been affected by the bird flu and to what extent?
We know that around the world, this particular strain of avian influenza has impacted more than 400 species of birds and mammals. And in some cases, those impacts have been quite substantial. So a recent estimate for Heard Island showed that about 13,000 elephant seal pups are thought to have died. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously a huge impact on that population. So
how much of a percentage of that population?
76% of the pups were thought to have been impacted. It's hard to know, of course, what that's going to mean for the population overall in the short term, but that's just an astronomically high number of pups that have died. So there's almost certain to be long-term consequences. And we've seen population declines for other species around the world similarly. So, you know, in the Falkland Islands and other places, we've seen, you know, big deaths also in Antarctica of seabirds and also marine mammals. And so We're really concerned of the potential for this in Australia, and it's really important that we're not alarmed about this. We need to be really alert and vigilant, but it's just far too early to predict what's going to happen in Australia.
But there hasn't been any modelling along those lines, Ewan?
There's been risk assessments that have been done in terms of species that we think are potentially really vulnerable. So the black swan is one that we're really worried about because it appears to have different genetics to swan species overseas. So it may not have the same immune abilities to, I guess, fight this virus. And I think one of the things we need to bear in mind, of course, with Australia is that many of our species are found nowhere else on Earth, and that means that they are, in many cases, genetically different. But it also means we don't have, you know, the same species overseas to learn from in terms of what we might expect in Australia. So it is really hard to predict with certainty what will happen. But we are concerned about species like the black swan, also the Australian sea lion, which, you know, again, is a threatened species, about 12,000 individuals left. And we think that that's highly vulnerable to this disease. The Tasmanian devil and the dingo. And so there's a whole range of ways that wildlife can, of course, contract this virus.
Can I just interrupt you? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, sure.
Did you say dingo?
Absolutely. The dingo, yeah, absolutely. So there's many ways that the virus can be, you know, come into contact with. So, of course, close proximity to birds, but also if and when these birds die, there are many animals that will be very happy to eat them. And so we have large numbers of predators, native predators, that includes quolls, dingoes, Tasmanian devils. And in some parts of Australia, of course, we know that the Tasmanian devil, as an example, has been already heavily impacted by the devil facial tumour disease and are already battling to recover from that. And so if large numbers of birds, as an example, end up dying in Tasmania, that could, of course, then flow on to affect the Tasmanian devil. And the dingo, as an example, here in Victoria, where we think in northwest Victoria, there may be fewer than 100 individuals left in the Big Desert Wiperfeld area. If the avian influenza was to arrive in that area and, again, result in bird deaths, the dingoes would eat those birds and potentially therefore contract that virus and die as well. So there is a range of species we're really worried about. And I think, as an ecologist, I'm also worried about how this will flow through to affect ecosystems. So as an example, if we think of large number of water birds dying in a waterway, away from potentially where people are, so it goes undetected, that could lead to a rapid deterioration of water quality, which could lead to, of course, things like fish kills. And if we think about, as an example, going back to devils and Tasmanian devils and dingoes dying, they are really important apex predators in those ecosystems. And so in the case of dingoes, if dingoes end up dying, then you might end up with, you know, much higher kangaroo numbers, which would flow on to affect, you know, the vegetation and other species in the ecosystem. So, of course, nature, as we all know, is interconnected. And so, you know, this virus won't just affect birds, but potentially, you know, mammals and of course, the ecosystems.
This is the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to Ewan Ritchie, who is a Professor of Wildlife Ecology and Conservation at Deakin. Ewan, you say not to worry, and then you've got a pretty bleak picture of how far and I guess how fast this might spread when you talk about things like immunity levels lacking in some of these animals. So what can be done?
There's a range of things that they get done. And the federal government, of course, you know, has spent about $113 million so far to prepare for this. And we have been lucky, inverted commas, in Australia so far that we've had longer to prepare for this than many other countries around the world. And so we are undertaking surveillance in many parts of Australia to look for obvious signs of diseased or distressed animals and then to check them to see if the flu has arrived. Because the sooner, of course, that we can take those animals into, custody and manage them rather than let it spread through the environment, the more chance we have of stopping the spread.
And I assume that the symptoms, the signs that you say are obvious, would be very different for each animal. Or would they?
Absolutely. And that's a really important point, because sometimes they will be really obvious and other times they won't be obvious at all. And so we're really urging members of the public to not approach wildlife. And you shouldn't be doing that anyway, even under normal circumstances. But if you see an animal behaving erratically or even a dead animal, please don't approach that animal. Please don't pick that animal up. Report it to authorities as quickly as possible and let them manage that situation. Because although the potential for the disease to be contacted by people is quite low, it can, in some cases, if it is contacted or contracted, I should say, be lethal, and in some cases 50%. So we really want people to...
People, right.
Yeah. So, and most of those cases have been in places like poultry farms where people are regularly coming into contact with, you know, chickens, et cetera, that in some cases have been infected. But of course, we want to do everything we can to reduce that likelihood. Other things, of course, that we're doing is captive breeding programs, you know, so we've got insurance populations so that should the worst happen and a species potentially be wiped out locally or even become extinct in the wild, then we have those populations that potentially we could then reintroduce into the wild later on. And then managing other threats. So, you know, one of the best defences we have against the impact of this disease is to ensure that our habitats are in good condition. Other co-occurring threats like invasive species are being managed to give wildlife the best possible chance they can of surviving this disease. Because when this virus does eventually become established in Australia, and it really is probably a case of unfortunately, if not when, it will spread rapidly because birds can fly many tens, hundreds, in some cases thousands of kilometres over quite short time periods. And so it'll be really hard. And of course, Australia is a really large and diverse continent, and there's many remote areas that aren't being regularly surveyed. So it'll be really hard to slow down the spread. So we'll have to move to a phase really of mitigating the impacts of the disease rather than preventing its spread entirely.
And so if it is inevitable, if it's when not if, then do we have a vaccination on the way or anything that we can manage it in the long term with?
Yeah, there are vaccinations available. But again, I guess that the issue with, you know, vaccinating particularly native wildlife is just the size of this continent. And that, of course, we just have large numbers of species that we simply just can't vaccinate. So, of course, we can manage our poultry really carefully because they are, of course, far more easy to contain than native animals are. But really, in many cases in our native wildlife populations, it's going to be very hard to vaccinate them in the wild. So it's going to be a range of approaches that we will need to take. But as I said earlier, we need to be aware and vigilant, not alarmed, because it is really early and we don't know if this disease has moved beyond those first two bird species that it was detected in. And then, of course, we'll have to assess from there.
You're listening to Ewan Ritchie. We're talking about the threat from bird flu. Before I let you go, Ewan, I guess there'll be people who think, look, I don't work on a poultry farm, so, you know, how will I be coming into contact with this? There are a couple of ways I'm thinking about, like people who feed birds potentially or people who go duck hunting. What can you tell us about how it might impact people who don't consider themselves at risk?
Yeah, that's right. We need to be really careful about our behaviours. So, of course, many people enjoy bird feeding, and that is a controversial practice in itself. And I'm not here to tell people to not feed birds. But if we are going to feed birds, you need to have really strict hygiene to make sure that you're not coming into contact with bird seed that birds have been feeding on, and making sure that you clean those feeding trays really regularly. Duck hunting is going to pose a real challenge for governments. Of course, it's just finished in Victoria, but now if we do have this disease emerging in Australia, we won't know, you know, in real time which birds are infected and which ones aren't. And if we have people and also hunting dogs coming into close proximity with potentially infected waterfowl, then that poses a real risk. And dogs are highly prone to this virus. So, and that raises another point that we should also be really vigilant about, again, making sure that our domestic animals, so cats and dogs, are not pursuing wildlife and not coming into contact with wildlife, because that's another pathway that not only they can be affected and potentially harmed or killed, but also that they can spread that disease to humans. And so really, again, it's a case of being just really responsible and vigilant.
Ewan, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mary.
That's Professor of Wildlife Ecology at Deakin University, Euan Ritchie, with a lot for us to think about, even though he says don't be alarmed. Let's pick up on that point about the lethality in the rare, underlined rare, case of human infection. Joining me now is Professor Paul Griffin, who's an infectious diseases physician and clinical microbiologist at the University of Queensland. Hi, Paul. What can you tell listeners about the risk from bird flu in terms of humans?
Yeah, thanks for having me. The risk at this stage to human health is definitely very low. And, you know, that's the main message at the moment, that this virus, as you've heard, potentially has a big impact, particularly in birds and the poultry industry and other animals. But the cases we've seen in humans have been very sporadic. It doesn't pass person to person at this stage, and has often arisen when people have had quite extensive close contact with sick or deceased birds or animals. And so we don't expect this to pose a significant risk to human health at this stage. But having said that, we don't want people to be complacent. And you just heard some excellent advice that if we see sick or dead birds or other animals in that region at this stage, we certainly want to hear about them. We want it to be reported, but do so in a safe way. Take a picture, record the location, and send that to relevant authorities. Don't pick up or come into contact with those birds so that we can make sure we minimise that risk.
Question from the owner of a golden retriever, Paul. What if your dog has a habit of eating, for instance, duck poo, and ingests something from an infected bird? What's my risk then?
Yeah, I mean, at this stage, that risk is very low because we haven't seen this established in ducks. And, you know, the duck population is a very significant one because of where they live and the fact that the virus can be transmitted in the water in which they spend most of their time after it's been excreted by them. So, you know, we hope that it doesn't rapidly establish in ducks for that reason and a variety of others. But, you know, those sort of situations where it would then be transmitted to a person or another mammal from those ducks would be something that isn't necessarily likely at this stage. So, you know, the risk to that person, once again, is extremely low.
Right. So between a dog, for instance, and a human, that's pretty easy to get around in terms of just basic hygiene.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. And the advice, for example, to, you know, make sure that domestic animals are having their contact with particularly wild birds limited, and that you know, you try and keep them separated and dissuade them from coming into contact or hunting or getting those sort of animals so that their risk of exposure is reduced is the main thing to consider at the moment.
We're talking with Paul Griffin about the implications of this bird flu eventually down the track for humans as well. A question that's come up, Paul, what about eating chicken and eggs into the future?
Yeah, so we don't think that there's going to be any significant risk of consuming chicken or poultry or their products. And, you know, there's a variety of reasons why we encourage those to be cooked well anyway. And so if that's adhered to, there's absolutely no risk there. And the other side of it is the active surveillance in those sort of farms and those locations, particularly those commercial producers, that if we're concerned there's bird flu there, those animals, unfortunately, will likely be destroyed and not enter the food chain that way. So the risk of consuming commercially available products, once again, is essentially negligible. Yeah, zero.
Mm. We've heard from Euan that, you know, there is no real modelling on this. We're just looking at all the scenarios that can come. So, I mean, into the future, you're talking about we're just going to keep the thoughts of how we prepare, for instance, chicken and so forth, just those norms that we have already will protect us.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's been a lot of work preparing for this. We're in some ways fortunate that we are the last continent to have to deal with this. And, you know, there's been a very heavy investment by government to make sure that we do have preventative strategies in place. And, you know, now we'll escalate those now that it has been detected on our shores. And, you know, that obviously includes wild birds as well as bird and poultry farms and the impact on human health as well. So there's excellent measures in place. Obviously, we have to step up our surveillance and the situation will likely evolve over time, and the main thing is people just need to make sure they keep getting their advice from reputable sources and following the recommended steps that have been well planned out and will be implemented when the time is right.
Mm. And we heard that vaccines are there for some animals. Are there vaccines for bird flu for humans, Paul?
yeah, there's been a lot of work preparing vaccines if they're needed. I mean, inherently, our ability to make new vaccines is better these days than it was in the past, and we can do that more successfully and more rapidly if we need to. But there has been a lot of work on bird flu vaccines for humans. Of course, we're certainly not suggesting that's something we're going to be rolling out anytime soon. There's no need for that now. But if it does become the case that a vaccine is required, we'll have one relatively quickly.
Paul, thank you so much for stepping us through all of that.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Griffin, Professor of Infectious Diseases and is a clinical microbiologist at the University of Queensland. Ina says, the loss forever of so many of our birds and animals is just terrifying. We all need to do what we are being asked to do. Someone else says, a strong argument for keeping cats inside. Of course, yes, lots of arguments there. It's been The Conversation Hour, and it's been a joy to be with you. Join me again tomorrow.